In all honesty, I've never felt like I've worked a day in my life. I don't know that I've met anyone that affected me so much. The jewel in the crown for me was always Capital.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which you hear from those who made a difference. Lynn Parsons.
I grew up in a very big house in Tooting Bec, quite a colourful household. My grandmother lived at the top, sometimes lodgers lived at the top as well, and then there was a middle section, and on the ground floor lived my family, and it was my dad's mum's house, and there were always lots of cats. So I was a baby boomer. There were 56 in my class at infant school. But we went to the most fantastic school for 3 or 4 years. The headmaster had a mortarboard, you know, wore the black cape all the time, and a cane. It was a boys' school, and they took the two boys and they took me. So I grew up from 8 until 11 at an entirely boys' school. It was a joy. It was fantastic. And then when I was 11, I think my parents went, "Oh my goodness, we've sent her to an all-boys school." And the worst thing in the world happened. They sent me to an all-girls school. It was a defining moment for me. I knew that I wasn't going to be into makeup and boys and high heels and clothes. And I would get 50 pence a week pocket money, and I would go and buy a single with that, a 7-inch single. From the moment I was born, it was Frankie Vaughan. But more importantly, Frank Sinatra at the Sands. And Live at the Sands had lots of him talking in between the songs. So as children, so I have two younger brothers, we would know not just the songs, but his jokes, and we could repeat those for the other children in the street. We had a back garden with a wall. They'd sit on the back garden wall, and we would entertain them.
Boy, I fell off the wagon with a boom bang last night, didn't I? I woke up this morning, my hair hurt.
My grandmother had records as well, so music had always been there, and we had a piano that my granddad, who went off with, it's one of those stories you don't want, but he left the piano, and my brothers and I were not musical. But the other thing I remember about my childhood is that we all had a radio. So there were lots of rooms in that house, and every single person in that house had a radio. And we would all go to bed listening to then LBC. So we'd be listening in our own rooms, drifting off to sleep, listening to Jeremy Beadle. You could hear us all laughing. You could hear... Literally, 21 Brenda Road would rock with laughter.
They pressed the profanity, and there I was chatting away to some lovely lady from She magazine. I said, "Never press the profanity, not us."
And we stayed with LBC, because I can remember listening to Robbie Vincent and absolutely adoring him, and finding out a bit more about him as I grew older. So talk radio was a really big thing.
Okay, it's Robbie Vincent's Nightline. I'm pleased to say on our Nightline newsmaker line, heading the poppy appeal. If you have a point to put to him,
I took 10 what were then O-levels. And when the letter came through the letterbox, unclassified, in every single subject. And my mum wasn't fazed at all. She went out and bought me a David Soul album, which kept me happy, and said, "Don't worry, as long as you're happy."
It brings a cold shiver inside.
And my dad panicked a bit and sent me on a Pitman's course, which I didn't enjoy at all. But I still have 120 words a minute shorthand. I can still do it. And 80 words a minute typing. I would go with my mum every Sunday to visit my grandmother in Catford from Tooting. And on the drive, we would listen to Capital Radio. So that's what I grew up with. So Peter Young, Roger Scott, they're the names that really meant something to me.
Frankie, we've only played 2 records so far, and it's 13 minutes after 9, we'll be here till midnight. That was the Stylistics, You Make Me Feel Brand New, number 99 on the new Hot 100. This is your hangover.
We would listen to Capital, and I remember Kenny Everett being on, I think it was a Sunday afternoon, and he said, "There's a hospital radio station in Tooting who are looking for people." I was 15. My mum said to me, "Well, you love music. that might be something you could get into. That's not necessarily girly. You don't have to talk about clothes and shoes and makeup there. So I went along, and actually it was at a psychiatric hospital, but it was called Radio 9 because it was supposed to, the purpose was to go out to 9 hospitals. And once again, in terms of confidence, so it was a psychiatric hospital, you were often aged 15 going and collecting dedications from the lockup ward. And we, you know, I laugh at that, but you know that there's that whole thing that Jasper Carrot says about the nutter sitting next to you on the bus. Because I'd had that experience when I was 15 through until about 18, mental health is such a big thing now. And I understood very, very quickly more about mental health. And actually, if someone that had mental health problems sat next to me on the bus, I would invariably sit and talk to them. Do you know what I mean? It was a different world. We're talking about a long time ago now. And I'm just so delighted that it's been embraced by everyone now. And it's just so open and everybody's talking about it. I loved working there. And we were at the top of the Fir Tower. It was Radio 9 from the top of the Fir Tower. The hospital itself was exquisite in terms of architecture. And you were able to pick your own songs. I remember someone saying, well, come on, you can do this. And it was a Sunday morning, and I love the Isley Brothers, so we started with Harvest for the World.
Oh, when will there be a harvest for the world?
Then I got a job as a shorthand typist for a film company. And that's when my world really opened. So I passed my driving test just after my 17th birthday. When I joined as the shorthand typist, they told me that they'd interviewed 50 people for the job. And the reason they'd given it to me was not because I was the best shorthand typist in the world, but I was the only one that had smiled as I'd come through the door. It was Humphrey's film. So they were working with 35mm, 16mm film, videotape, VHS, and Betamax had just come out. They said, we'd really like to teach you film and television. And I said, absolutely. So at 16, I was probably seeing films and editing films that perhaps I shouldn't have been. And though I do remember vividly when video first came out, everybody wants to see all the old classics of The Magnificent Men in their flying machine. And that was the first big run we'd done. So we're talking about maybe 25,000 copies of it, where someone had said they'd invented this security thing where you couldn't record off of it. I remember us recording, certainly running at least 10,000 off, finding that this security thing didn't work.
Those magnificent men in their flying machine, they go up to the up, up.
Whilst I was there, I had, for a long time, had my thoughts. So my great-grandfather invented the pickup system on a record player. And was a little bit nutty, a little bit mad, and he didn't copyright it. So a neighbour stole it, which sent him completely over the edge. But for some reason, that had sparked an interest in science for me. I had always wanted to be a television cameraman. But every time you said that to anyone at school, because that wasn't the done thing, they'd go, oh no, you can't do that, you can't do that. One day when I was at Humphreys, someone rang, and it was a rare thing for me to answer the phone. It was TVAM. And I said, no, what's TVAM? And they said, oh, we're a new breakfast television station and we're just getting ourselves organised. And I said, oh, can I have the details? So I sent my details with view to possibly being a television cameraman or a VT operator, because that's what I was learning, on breakfast television. And I remember vividly going for the interview for that. They thought the camera work might be very heavy, but they were not in any way saying you can't do it as a woman, but you're quite short, Lynn, and it might be heavy. The VT operating, what do you know about it? So I told them what I knew about it, and they went, well, that's quite interesting. And they said, well, we haven't got any jobs for VT operators. And they said, we have got a job in the sound department or the graphics department. And I said, I don't know anything about sound or graphics. And they said, no, but you're laughing, you're smiling, and that's what we need. We need someone that can come in and learn. And then they called me and said, you're coming in as a sound engineer, when TVAM started. I was so young, and I was working with people that had worked all over the world, some of them at retirement age, taught you the best of their skills. But also, the station was started by David Frost, Richard Key, Anna Ford, Angela Rippon, Michael Parkinson. So we would sit and have breakfast with these people every day. And I learnt to solder XLR things. And we actually built this station that then went on air. And of course, the press about it, you've only got to put TVAM into the internet. Roller coaster. So it was down, up, down, up. But we were living that. Our day started at 4 a.m. I was probably 19. None of my family or friends were interested in what I did. It was as if it was the most normal thing in the world to be sitting next to David Frost talking about what you saw on television the night before or how you were having problems sleeping. I learnt so much from these people. They were incredible. And I could tell you so many stories, but some of them are so personal and so private that it wouldn't be fair. But for a 19, 20-year-old, that was just another world.
Hello, good morning and welcome to TVAM. New studios, a new news service and a new national network.
So I was a sound engineer at TVAM. I've gone in as a sound engineer. I learnt very quickly, but that meant spending quite a lot of time with celebrities, putting a microphone, threading it up through their clothes and making it look quite nice. So there were the main presenters at the time. It would have been Nick Owen and Diamond, David Frost, Michael Parkinson, just lovely, lovely people. I remember when Mad Lizzie used to do her fitness thing and she'd always say to me, actually, I was the only girl in the studio when she used to do that. And I don't know why that was, because there were lots of other women working there. But when I worked and Mad Lizzie was on, I would always stand the other side of the camera and do what she was asking us to do.
Left and right.
But I had my eye on vision mixing. I used to go and sit with the vision mixer. And then the word came out they were looking for two trainee vision mixers. And here I go again. I'm going for an interview for something. I don't have any qualifications. I don't have a degree. And everyone else they're seeing has a degree. And I remember going into the green room and I remember taking my shoes off and crossing my legs and smiling, probably laughing and thinking, you don't have a chance in hell of them looking at you for this. And I got the job. But I was trained by the top vision mixer at the BBC and I was trained live on air. So Good Morning Britain would go out a month on the live show, and on the hour you would get the news. So there would be another studio where the news would be, and it would be people like Gordon Honeycomb reading the news. Oh my goodness, what a lovely man.
Hello, good morning. The news from TVAM. The government faced a rebellion by more than
1640 It was just fantastic. And vision mixing is the most exciting job in the world. And I say that without any qualms. It is so exciting. Literally, you have a free hand and you are what you think someone wants to see at home is where you're going with this. They'd say, coming to us in 5, 4. And as that happened, my hands would go ice cold and my heart would beat so fast it was coming out of my back. But you felt alive. My God, you felt alive. So exciting. So at the same time as I was doing that, I was doing one evening a week, a Saturday evening at County Sound, because it was still there. That whole radio thing was still there. And I would lay awake at night thinking, I love vision mixing, but actually, I think where I should place myself is somewhere where I can talk. So I was vision mixing the Wide Awake Club every weekend, Saturday and Sunday on TVAM. That was my shift, and you'd get live music, you'd get all sorts of things. They said they were going to look for a new presenter for the Wide Awake Club, and they had 6 audition places ready. I was on for the day, being the vision mixer, and the 4th presenter that was coming to audition didn't turn up. So the director said, does anybody here want to go for a laugh? And they all called me Linny. Linny, you should go out and do this. This would be so funny. And as I left the gallery to go in, the director shouted after me, you can have as much fun as you like because you're not what I'm looking for. And that's exactly what you need. It's like someone lighting a match under you, isn't it? So I went in and did the audition and the director said, the job's yours. Do you want to do it? And I said, I don't want to do it. And he said, I need to see you in my office tomorrow morning. So I went to see him on the Monday, and he said to me, no, this is ridiculous. And I said, no, I love vision mixing. And he said, no, you are so wasted. I really would love to see you on television. And I said, I can't do it. Because I'd watched incredible presenters on the television, and particularly women in those days, you put on about 16 pounds in front of a camera that look emaciated in real life. I mean, it's just the way, I guess, if you have to keep looking at yourself, you would. And I said to him, I love my food. I love chocolate. If I watched myself on television, I would not like myself. Told him I like radio and that I was doing some hospital radio. And he said, I'll have a bet with you. So he said, have you got a cassette of you presenting? And I said, well, yeah, somewhere at home. So he said to me, what station do you listen to? So I said, oh, I listen to Capital Radio. And he said to me, right. So he said, I'm going to have a bet with you that if you drop a tape off with them, they will offer you a job. And I said, oh, no, I don't think they will, because I'm still listening to Kenny Everett and Richard Allinson. And, you know, I'm thinking, no, no, no. And apart from anything else, there were not a lot of women. So you kind of don't. It's a subliminal thing. You don't hear yourself there. So I did a little note and a cassette and dropped it off the following day as a bet. Checked who I had to address it to. I had to address it to Richard Park at Capital. And it took me an hour and a half to drive home from TVAM. And when I got home, there was a message on my answer phone from Richard Park saying, I never get tapes from women. Come in and see me. And then I started to get a little bit worried. I thought, you know, fate's having its way a little bit with me. So I went for the interview, and Richard was really complimentary. And I explained what I did for a living. And he said to me, I'd want you to come here full time. And I said, no, that'd be ridiculous. Absolutely not. I love vision mixing. And then a week after, as fate would have it, there was a massive industrial dispute. We all lost our jobs. There were 234 of us that were like family. So that was devastating. And I got home and there was a message from Richard Park on my answer phone. And it said, you don't have a job now, according to the newspaper. Will you come and work for me now? So I applied for a job as a vision mixer in Southampton at TVS. And they said, we don't want you as a vision mixer. We'd like you as a technical operations manager that can explain things in layman's terms. You're very good. You smile a lot. So the communication thing again. And we'll give you £60,000 a year. And Richard Park said, come and work for me one evening a week for £25. And I went and worked for Richard Park for £25. I couldn't pay my mortgage. I just got married. And actually, Capital, my God, like real treasure to be working alongside these people that I had listened to and totally loved. And I also, in my mind, thought, if I have to go to Southampton every day and I've just got married, I should probably end up getting divorced and not spending much time with my husband. So there was a bit of both. I thought, you know, fate's having its way a little bit with me. But can I tell you that prior to sending this, I had actually written to Richard Allinson telling him that I listened to him on my way in to TVAM, because he used to do early breakfast TVAM every morning and I loved it, and that at some point in my dreams I would really like to be doing what he was doing. And he handwrote back to me, and recently I found that letter and I brought it into him, and he said to me, oh, it's a Capital headed paper, is it from Richard Park? And I went, I'd like you to have a look. And I said, I'm still working with you, and all those years ago I was listening to you on my way in.
1:10 in London, Simply Red stars, and from summer 1980, Bob Marley and the Wailers, they were jamming. Wednesday night into Thursday morning on 958, Lynn Parsons. Around the World in 60 Seconds. Ahead of that, the Love Parade, 1:30 through 2. It's
Richard was aware that I was struggling financially. He gave me work within the music department, which meant that I was there till quite late at night. So I did it because he said, I'll make up your money so that you can pay your mortgage and da-da-da-da. But then I got 5 nights a week, which made a huge difference. What a fantastic time to be broadcasting in London. And in those days, there was not a huge number of radio stations available. So, you know, Capital was a really big station. And we were playing CDs and actually occasionally discs still. It's very different today. And if you work at the BBC, you have the privilege of having a producer. You have people to answer the phones. You have people that keep you in your zone, thinking about what you might want to be saying next. But those overnights at Capital were priceless because you learnt to do everything. So you were doing the technicals, you were making sure that music was there, you were even filling out the music on a PRS form, answering your own phones, putting callers through. Once again, you feel alive and with music, which was really a joy.
If you want to be part of it, you better be quick. It's first come, first serve. Already received quite a few letters about it. Lynn Parsons, the Love Parade.
It was a
Christmas
busy
morning.
Old building. So we had Richard Attenborough was at the Euston Tower. You had the Busby Berkeley staircase that you would go up and down, and all the famous people from Quincy Jones to Chaka Khan would walk up and down those stairs. It was fantastic. All had their photographs taken on it. At one point, there was this hip-hop artist that was sitting in for Tim Westwood after me, who would come in and he'd have his cap on backwards and he'd be playing all this amazing music. And I would always make sure that my last three songs were something really kick-ass, you know, that was what I loved. I've always stood. Richard Park taught me to stand when I broadcast, so I have always stood and danced. So James Brown's Living in America, from those days at Capital. And I would quite often, if we had one of these amazing rappers that thought that they were incredible and they were from New York, I'd finish and they'd go, "What's that?" And I'd go, "James Brown, Living in America." I just absolutely loved being at Capital. There are certain things I remember. Of course, I was there at the same time as Paul McKenna. So often we'd have late at night little soirees in the engineering room, MCR, where Paul was practicing his hypnotising. So there were those. But I can remember vividly meeting David Jensen. So I was being shown round Capital and I went into MCR and there was David Jensen, who I had listened to for so many years. I couldn't believe him. He came up to me and he said, "You must be Lynn. My name is David. I do the Drive Time show here and I do the chart show." On, as if I didn't know him. I found that an incredible... You know, of course I knew who he was, but he's like that today as well. I love David Jensen. Not just a great broadcaster, but the incredible humble man. Really lovely man.
I got the power. We got the power on 95.8. Plenty of it. You know, the way it is tonight,
and then
it was
Peter Young. Oh, my goodness. Peter Young. I had so many mad nights with Peter Young and Tim Westwood. Oh, my goodness. I mean, you just wouldn't put us together in the same room ordinarily. But my God, we were pals. And Fluff Freeman was obviously there. So when you'd walk into the music department, you'd get Peter would go, "All right, Parsons, in here." And he'd go, "Listen to this. This is a great new song." But whatever it was, he'd go, "Listen to this. This is fantastic." It was an age when that did go on. And Westwood would have something to play us that was a little bit on the rap side of things. And Fluff and Kenny Everett, a complete genius, but an introverted extrovert. So therefore, he would go out the back way and he didn't do a lot of talking, but was a genius on air.
Please don't let me tread all over the intros of records. Oh, say a naughty word.
Jackie Brambles came to Capital. She was lovely. She went to Radio 1. She called me, she said, "Johnny Beeling, my boss, who was in charge of Radio 1 at the time, has heard you, wonders whether you'd come and have a chat with him." I was surprised. I had not ever heard Radio 1 before because I was a Capital girl. The jewel in the crown for me was always Capital. I didn't want to jump because they had been so good to me at Capital. And I wasn't really sure what I was getting into, so I started to listen. I remember saying to Richard, I fancied something after 4 years. I fancied a shot at something. So I made a recording of myself doing the network chart I didn't actually think that he would ask me to do it, but I thought, well, let's do that. And left that on his desk and said, look, I know that's not where you hear me, but I'd like to do that. And he wibbled a bit and went, the figures are really good at night. I don't think we want to mess with this. But after 4 years of overnights, you are surviving on those kind of hours and driving yourself home as well. It can be quite lonely. And I was surviving on a lot of Lucozade and chocolate and coffee. And that isn't very good for your body. I mean, it's not very good for your mind either. And I think that's when Radio 1 came to the rescue. And I thought, well, let's go and talk to Johnny Beeling, just because there's no movement here at the moment. And actually, nights are pretty, as anyone will tell you, I don't know if you've ever worked nights. My God, it messes with your body and your mind, doesn't it? Radio 1 FM. I don't remember going into a room and there was Johnny Beeling and maybe Chris Lycett. And they asked me a few questions. And I said to them, I've also got my own headphones, if that's going to help. And they said, will you come and work here? And I said, I need to go back and talk to my boss. And they said, what, so he'll offer you more money? No, because that's not how I do business. I said, Richard Park employed me and I have huge respect for him. And I need to run this past him before. And they said, well, we can sign you could sign a contract now. And I said, I'll shake your hand on it. I'd like to come. And that was for 2 weekend shows. I said, but I must, you know, out of courtesy, I must wait. And I did wait until Richard came back from his holiday. And when I saw him, he said to me, oh, you decided you'd had enough at night time. I went, I really was looking to growing a bit. And he said, are you going somewhere else? And I said, well, I am, but I really wanted to tell you first. I haven't signed a contract. So he said, so it's a negotiable. And I went, no, it's not negotiable, but just out of courtesy, I'm going to Radio 1. And actually, I think he was really surprised. And leaving Capital was difficult. I cried. I didn't want to leave Capital. I had to leave Capital in order to get better, in order to grow in broadcasting. But also, I felt I couldn't do those overnights anymore. I can remember, because I was friends with Jackie, going to visit her at Broadcasting House. There'd always been this connection with my great-grandfather because I loved records, and the fact that he designed this pickup system. Just that building, Broadcasting House, you know, at Oxford Circus. There's just something about it. And the commissionaires and everything. I mean, it was enormous. And obviously, once you get into a studio, it's the same. You're talking to one person. My main concern in terms of nerves was because I had said for 4 years, you're listening to Capital, was that I was going to say that. So I did write down that I was at BBC Radio 1. I was not fazed by the names I met. I bumped into probably Steve Wright to start with, then Simon Bates, all very welcoming. Truthfully, I didn't have a major knowledge of them. And I can remember going in to see John Peel. Oh my goodness. I can remember going in to see John Peel. And he was playing a song. I remember him saying, come in, you must be Lynn. Oh, I've had a bit of a morning. I've had to clear my mum's house up this morning. So he went into this kind of automatic, not talking about music at all. And that was very surreal. So I was familiar with John Peel. And I don't know why that would be, but I was familiar with John Peel. Annie Nightingale. That name doesn't get mentioned enough. I cannot tell you how lovely she was to me. She was just extraordinary. And she would be there late at night planning her shows because we were able to play music we wanted to. I'd got 2 shows where I was able to plan. There would have been a playlist that we were all involved in. We could go along to the playlist and take songs that we thought should go on. But you would then be able to build a show yourself. So late at night when I was building shows, Bob Harris was building shows. Annie Nightingale was building shows. It was fantastic. And then Fluff came across. Fluff had his own office. And in the whole time I knew Fluff, and his name will, if I was to talk to people about radio, his name will always come up. In the whole time I knew Fluff, he worked at different radio stations. And I think deliberately would, when he went to one radio station, wear the T-shirt for another. I mean, it was joyous. And I remember him leaving Radio 1 and coming in for at least 5 years afterwards and keeping his office there. And you'd hear Madam Butterfly being played really loudly. And then you'd go in there and just sit with him and you'd both be crying because it was just a moving 78 that he'd got out of the library. You know, you just give him a key. Fluff would have a key everywhere and be welcome any time of day. He was just amazing. I just had the best time of my life. And as I say, it's documented, particularly when Matthew came in, there were many, many changes. But the one thing in life that you can guarantee is that things are never going to stay the same. They will always change. And I think you just have to go with it. You have to embrace it. And even when Matthew was there, and I know there were people that were very angry at that time, I had the best time. I've always felt incredibly lucky. And I've sometimes had chats with people like Simon Bates and they go, no, love, you're not lucky. We're lucky to have you. And I go, no, actually, I know I'm lucky. I absolutely know I'm lucky. And that's what makes it easy to laugh. When things don't go so well behind the scenes, it's never personal. It's just about something bigger to do with the radio station. I'm so grateful I've got a job now. You've got to go out in shorts. Oh, goodness, it was fantastic. It was, you know, the sex and drugs and rock and roll. It was just rock and roll and hot chocolate. It absolutely was. There's probably 70 of us involved, from technicians to drivers to... Richard Greaves was amazing. His job was to go out and check out all the restaurants and hotels before we went out on the road. But it was like a big family for 9 weeks. Fantastic seaside towns I had never seen. And then you would just be introduced on a stage and it was really quite surreal because I'd be this little girl thinking, oh, I look terrible in my shorts. And then there'd be a jingle that would go, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the stage, Lynn Parsons. And then you just sort of almost become someone else to walk out there and have the confidence to say, how's everybody feeling today? You know. We stayed in these hotels and some of them were quite quirky, but even the bands, I never saw any funny business. And certainly we would sit up till 2 o'clock in the morning in hotel bars drinking hot chocolate, and you'd have a band that were on and they'd sit and play acoustically. You would melt and then you'd go to bed with the teddy that you had in your bag with your spare pants and your... I've always, wherever I've worked, had to carry spare pants in my bag. I carry the spare pants because I'm absolutely notorious for wetting myself laughing, and I've always done that prior to children and since children. Always wet myself laughing, which is probably the mark of having a good time, isn't it?
Would be Scritti Politti and the Soup Dragons, Divine Thing, thanks to Tommy Vance, Johnny Walker and Nicky Horn, the boys flying the flag for 1FM at Wembley tonight. What a fantastic night. It's 10:31 in the UK, Lynn Margaret Parsons in for Nicholas Andrew Argyle Campbell, into the night of 1FM.
At Capital, there were often calls while you were on air going, you didn't mention the name of the station there, you didn't do that. So there was criticism while you were on air. There was this constant trying to get better, trying to get tighter. And even when I listened to those days, the shows were much tighter. You weren't necessarily saying very much. And then when you got to the BBC, you literally had a voice. You could relax a bit. And they totally trusted you. They would say to me, right, we've got Elton John coming in. Can you interview him next week? It was just assumed that you could do it. And what came with that was that you worried less because they gave you the confidence. They let go and gave you the confidence to actually be yourself. So I did lunchtimes, I did early mornings, I did late nights. I think the best time to be on is late night because people are listening to you and the feedback I get. Radio nowadays is so different. So I'm not putting CDs in. I'm not playing jingles and things. I'm playing from a main central system. And so social media is a really big thing for me now. Certainly on Mellow Magic, when I start, I give people ways of contacting me. And there are four ways. So text, tweet, email, Facebook. And it's so busy all night and you never know what's going to come in. And so whilst your little box in front of you is playing through the songs and you know you've got a link coming up, I'm spending that time, rather than listening to the music and thinking what I'm going to talk about music-wise, thinking, right, OK, where how can I link these? So it's changed so massively. It's not what I would have chosen when I got into radio originally, but I do love it. It's about, as I said to you, you can guarantee that things are going to change. They're never going to stay the same. And it's about embracing them and seeing how you can make them work for you.
His Royal Purpleness, Prince with Peach and Rush, Spirit of Radio on 1FM. So what's in store tonight? Well, there's the Erogenous Zone Part 1 at 12:45.
I was doing nighttime and I was not very well. And I was really not very well. And no one could find out what was wrong. And my husband was driving me into the work on the back seat of the car, feeling really rough. But I wanted to keep working. Nobody really knew what was wrong. And then they discovered I was pregnant. So it was time for a change, because those hours wouldn't have been good. I'd always been told that I would never have a baby. So now I had one, or I had one on the way. So I left about 4 weeks before I had my first son. And as soon as I had him, they rang and said, can you do 9 weeks of the roadshow? Can you come back and do 9 weeks of the roadshow? I said, do you know, I can't do that because I've just had a baby. And they said, let's speak to your husband. Because that's, I mean, everybody was very family orientated. And they said, well, how could we work this out? So he, out of the 9 weeks, my husband said he would have the first week, the middle week and the last week off. So I did the roadshows. And whilst that was going on, I got a call from Mark Story, who was at Virgin, then Virgin, who said, can you come in and talk to me? And I started a weekend show there. So I finished those road shows and went straight into that. But the weekend didn't interfere with bringing up baby, really. And then slowly and slowly it gets under your skin again, doesn't it? And you start to do a little bit more. And then I ended up doing, because when Chris Evans came, he always wanted Friday off to do TFI Friday. I did Friday, Saturday, Sunday breakfast. So it was back in commercial radio with a bang. You were doing everything yourself, but I'd had the training at Capital, which took you back to that kind of broadcasting. There was a lot of split links because we went out nationally and in London. And I met Jonathan Ross, who I was a huge fan of. And I'd never, ever met. So Jonathan Ross was coming in and I knew Jonathan Ross is coming in. And I think it's the only time I've ever washed my hair before I've come into work. And when he walked through the door, I didn't see him come in because the studio was set up so that the door was behind you. Not good feng shui, can I say, but that's how it was set up. And I turned round and there was a man on his knees who was the same height as me, but he was on his knees because Jonathan's quite tall. And he took my hand and he kissed it and he said, you must be Lynn, I'm Jonathan. Be still my beating heart. He was just, I learned so much from him, actually. You learn something from everybody you meet, don't you? And I do know that the engineer, won't name him, that was supposed to drive Jonathan's desk, obviously used to have very late nights and didn't always get there. And Jonathan just said to me one day, you can't stay here and drive the desk for me. And I went, oh, I'm very happy to do that. He said, no, just show me how it works. And he said, no, you just leave me. I thought that the no fear about Jonathan Ross, I learnt from that. I went on to do some things that I might have been scared of prior to that. It's interesting, isn't it, that you watch someone and you think, I can't believe he's never worked a desk before and he's just come in and gone, how does this work? You can't keep, you know, hanging on. You're not paid to do this. I'll do it. And just a really lovely man. And I don't know whether people know that, because he often makes jokes about people. He's totally dedicated to Jane. He is a really lovely, down-to-earth man. I think years ago he sold his company for a penny or something just to be with the children. He let Jane go out to work. He wanted to spend more time with the children. very genuine, and sometimes he'd make jokes about you. Sometimes he was on before me, and he'd always come back and go, "Oh, you know that joke I did about you before you came in? You know that that was just purely for on air. You know that that's not what I think at all." I just have tremendous respect for him, actually. Really lovely man.
I'm hungry. I'm hungry.
I'm Simon.
Oh dear!
You just spoiled a very, very fine piece of comedy radio. I was going at then. I hope you feel chagrined. I'm hungry for some travel and traffic.
I was still working at Virgin, and I heard Michael Parkinson on a Sunday. I was driving home from Virgin at 11 o'clock one Sunday morning, and I heard Michael Parkinson, who I'd worked previously with at TVAM, do an interview with Paul McCartney.
What were the practical ambitions, though, of that child in Liverpool, dreaming away there at the bus stop? I mean, what did you want to be?
It involved money.
And it was fantastic. It was absolutely fantastic. And I started to think about Radio 2. I think when you're at Radio 1, you think, well, Radio 2's a bit grown up. And as a child, I can remember being bathed on a Sunday night, be put into bed listening to Radio 2's Sing Something Simple. Sing Something Simple. Oh, it was lovely. And it was a choir. And so I did remember that from Radio 2. And I found out who the boss was, and it was Jim Moyer. Really should have been an entertainer himself and had a fantastic history of with the two Ronnies, etc., etc. So he'd gone to Radio 2. I wrote him a note and said, I grew up having a bath on a Sunday night listening to Sing Something Simple. I've listened to this. I heard Michael Parkinson do the most amazing interview with Paul McCartney. I know that you must have a list of names, you know, the length of my inside leg measurement, that want to work for you. If you ever want someone just to cover for anyone, I have worked in broadcasting for quite a while. You've probably never heard of me. Here are a couple of examples of things I do or I've done. And he called and said, come and see me. And Jim Moyer said, yes, I do have a list of names. I quite like you. I mean, I quite like you. You just, there's something about you. How would you feel? How would you feel about doing two late nights from Birmingham? And I said in my avant-garde way, of course. Of course I'll drive up to Birmingham from London. And at the time, there was this, of course, everything shouldn't be based in London. We know that. And now there's Manchester-based stuff. There's stuff coming out of Scotland. I mean, it should be about the whole of the UK. But in those days, there was this thing written into the rules about Birmingham. And often the newsreader in London would have driven from Birmingham to do their shift. And I would drive up the motorway from London to do this. But I had a gig where I could talk. I could pick a little bit of music. I could have some responses from audience. I could have some feedback. And as I say, that late night thing, you can actually have a conversation with someone and know that they're listening. During the day, I know that there are huge numbers of people listening on their way to work and da 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 da, but they're only listening for little bits. Late at night, people are listening for company. They're listening for very different reasons, actually. I think if you talk to a listener, they go, oh, I'd like to think they would say, well, she's my friend. But actually, it works the flip side for me. I feel that these regulars, and that I've probably got, I don't know, 500 regulars at night, and everybody wants to know what everybody's doing. It's a bit of a club that's going on, you know? It's a lovely, I don't feel like I'm coming to work. In all honesty, I've never felt like I've worked a day in my life. I've been tired because I've done strange shifts, but I've never felt like I've worked. It's just been like coming to be with a friend. It's lovely. Hey, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Allinson. Back next weekend on Radio 2. Missing you already. Morning, you. How are you doing? Looking good. And then there was a bit of controversy, and we won't mention about the controversy. We won't. We'll sweep that under the carpet, shall we? But it meant that Richard Allenson, who had... See, now, Richard Allenson, who I'd written to all those years ago, and he'd written back to me, they said, would you like to do Richard Allenson's show for the foreseeable future? And I said... Oh, and they went, it's OK, he's doing afternoons, because I never really liked that whole thing of you know, moving in. I can remember, going off subject again, Annie Nightingale. They gave me the request show for a year before I left Radio 1. And I remember calling Annie and her going, I know why you've called. It's OK. Because she'd done the request show for so long and then they'd started moving things around. So I don't like that. And I'd not make good management at all. I couldn't manage a radio station. So Richard Allenson did afternoons for a year. I did his show for a year. My goodness me, that gave me the opportunity to meet some... I did some huge learning curve. I interviewed people because I had no qualifications. When they'd say, right, OK, we've got this man who's a philosopher, who's famous the world over, you're going to interview him tonight. And I'd go, oh, I don't think I can do that. But then you would have producers that would say, yes, of course you can. Here's what you need to research. You'll do it. Tori Amos joins us in the studio. Welcome, Tori.
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
During the course of that show, I met some incredible people. And I'm going to mention one because he left such an impression on me. And, you know, it was everything from royalty to writers. And some of them were difficult. Even back in my TVAM days, I'm doing a bit of a switch here, when I had to put microphones on people, the people that you absolutely loved, that you thought would be fabulous, were horrible, and vice versa. And I remember meeting Diana Dawes back at TVAM because she did a series for them. And I'd never really liked her before. And yet she was the most beautiful human being. She was really lovely and kind to me, whereas some of the people that I really like were really horrible when you were sticking your hand up their jumper. And whilst we're on that subject, can I just go back to the fact that I once mic'd up Prince Andrew. And at that point, I would have been about 26, maybe younger. I bit my nails and he went, ugh! You bite your nails. And I stopped biting my nails. So he had an effect on me. Anyway, Diana Dawes was lovely and I wasn't expecting her to. But now let's go back to the Richard Allenson show. I had the opportunity to interview Sir Edmund Hillary. And everyone knows that he climbed to the top of Everest. Did a lot for the Sherpas after he did that. But there was so much to his life. Whilst he was out there, his wife and child had flown in and he watched the plane land and it burst into flames and they died. And his stories, he brought his stories to life in his book, but to talk to him, I don't know that I've met anyone that affected me so much. Really, really lovely man. There were people that came in that were really dodgy. I learnt, interestingly, at Radio 1 on lunchtimes when I was interviewing people, and used it more so during that process of interviewing someone every night at Richard Allenson's show, that everybody is quite human. And normally if they're on this kind of thing of, oh, I've got to sell this film, I've got to sell this book, they can come in and be having bad days. And I learnt very quickly that once you were left on your own with someone, you were able, with the mic down, to say, what sort of day have you had? And on many occasion, I'd have someone sitting opposite me that was hugely famous who would say, I've had such a shit day and the last place I want to be is here. And I would always say to them, do you know something? We don't need this tonight. Would you like to come back when you're feeling better? And sometimes they would. And sometimes they'd go, oh my God, no. It's fine. But it would change the dynamic. It would be that you respected them enough not to just want, but to just empathise, you know, that there was something going on in their world that, you know, I'm reluctant to say because there've been so many occasions. I'm reluctant to share who because it's a personal thing, isn't it? And you wouldn't want to do that. So that was a huge learning curve for me. And I definitely feel that my interviewing technique got better through that particular show. It was a lovely, lovely show. Really sad to let that go, but Richard did have to come back. Barry Manilow and Copacabana. You can see him with the twirling arms and the puffed up sleeves, can't you? It is Lynn Parsons with you until 7. Great to have your company. Charlotte Worth on board, as always, producing. I did a lot of shifts for Sarah Kennedy, so ended up spending quite a lot of time with Terry Wogan, who was just a real monkey and lovely, just exactly no different on air to off air or vice versa, just really, really lovely.
Yes, it's the Gupta Wogan Show. Thank you to Lynn. How nice to have her with us.
And then something absolutely wonderful happened in my private life. I was always told I couldn't get pregnant. They said the first baby was a miracle baby. 8 years had passed by. And another miracle baby arrived, and it wasn't IVF or anything, so a gift from heaven, which did once again make me think, actually, I need to take a step back. So I did take a step back, but still did continue to do stuff at Radio 2. At the same time, now, isn't it really interesting? So I spent probably a couple of years focusing on that child and doing that child and doing little bits of stand-in. And then suddenly, 2006, I got really poorly and I had a condition called hyperparathyroidism, which it took them a long time to diagnose, but it meant I had a year out. And in that year, I had a lovely friend called Martin, who had been an editor at the BBC, who said, but you're not working on radio. This is just ridiculous. So he set me up podcasting. So I started writing podcasting shows, and they were comedy shows, when I felt well. Then they found out what was wrong with me, and I had lots of operations, and I was better. That involved an awful lot of incredible consultants and surgeons and things. So I'm here to tell the story, and I'm very grateful for that. But it made me look at life differently. It made me realise that I shouldn't really be spending every single day in a studio. And the opportunities kept coming. I felt and have felt and still feel really blessed. The opportunities continue to come and I still laugh every day. But at the same time, Sarah Kennedy left Radio 2. At the same time as that happened, there were some people setting up a radio station called Smooth. So they called me in and it was a lovely man called Gavin McCoy. And they said, would you come and do a couple of shifts for us? And I said, oh, you know, I haven't been very well and I think I probably shouldn't overdo it. And they went, oh, what would you like to do? Why don't you do a Saturday show? So I said, OK, I'll do a Saturday show. So I did it. And then 2 days later, Gavin McCoy called me into his office and he said to me, no. And I said, oh, you don't like it. It's fine. It's fine. I prefer people to be honest. And he went, no, we can't just have you on one day a week. This is ridiculous. We'd like you on more days. And I just was very quiet because I was really shocked. And it's the only time I've ever been quiet in my life. And he said to me, we'll double your money. It's the money that's not right, isn't it? I was trying to say, well, no, I wasn't expecting this. And he went, we'll give you even more. Do you want more money? And he had a tremendous sense of humour. He and Steve Wright spend a lot of time together. So, you know, an off-air Steve Wright, really. I've got many funny stories about him. Lionize the Eagles on Smooth Radio. Well, do you know, we started at 10. I don't know where you've been, but we've had an enormous number of texts, tweets, emails, photos. So I ended up at Smooth, as well as freelancing. It just suddenly became okay to work for commercial and the BBC. But my lovely friend Kevin Greening then died. And I'd got this 3-year-old and they said, would you do 5 days a week? We don't want it to be someone else. And that was one of the most difficult things I've ever had to do. Because it wasn't because someone was getting the sack. It was because my friend had died. So I did it for a little while and then did breakfast at Smooth as well as still doing the Radio 2 stuff. So maybe overdoing it a little, you know, in terms of hours, but loving it, absolutely loving it. I don't watch much television, but I was working one morning on Smooth. I was doing the breakfast show and there was someone out in it was in Castlereagh Street and there was this window. So everyone from the window could see the studio. 7 o'clock in the morning, a man came to the glass window and bent right down to street level and with his tongue licked up the window. And I thought,
oh my God, oh my God, what are we going to do? So I buzzed Seb and I said, Seb, we've got someone that's not quite right outside that's licking the window. So he said, oh, I'll come through. Anyway, he brought the man in and took him through to the music department. And he came through and he said to me, you don't know who that is, do you? And I said, no, I said, but he bloody frightened me. And he said, it's Rick Mayall. And I went running out to the music department. I swear to you, I've never been this forward with anyone. And I walked straight up to him and I kissed him on both sides of his cheek. Bang, 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 bang. And I said to him, you frightened me out of my bloody life. It was just... But he was like that, I understand. I mean, just really, really like the character in Bottom and The Young Ones. So my memories of Smooth... Also, when Bates came, I mean, when Simon Bates came, so many stories. Hilarious. He went to broadcast live at Christmas from Afghanistan with the troops, with Seb, his producer, and they sent us a Christmas tree. The Christmas tree arrived and came in sideways, and it was 45 feet high. We had to cut the top off because it didn't fit. That man was so funny. And is so funny, and is, I think he had quite a reputation years ago. He has mellowed deliciously, and he is just so funny. He laughs so much and tells such great stories. He really does. He should still be on the radio.
Hark, the herald angels sing. It's Simon Bates here. I've been sent over to this brand new channel. Very clean here, isn't it? To explain what's happening on Smooth Radio UK right now. I'm there.
I left Smooth when they transitioned across to Global. And I was offered, because I love jazz, the breakfast show at Jazz, which I did for a year. And that was fantastic. Working with music, I absolutely loved. We were in a place in Margaret Street. And it was like people that were really passionate about music again. So I'd gone back to that because, you know, you kind of, that comes in and out depending on where you're working, especially when the music's programmed for you. Louis Armstrong, What a Wonderful World. Jazz Breakfast from Monday. Hope your weekend was good. It's Lynn Parsons with you until Christmas.
Where are we now? So a year at Jazz and then
Radio 2 gave me a call at the same time as Tony Morey. I went to see Radio 2 and lovely Lewis Carney said to me, you're not on the radio at the moment. And I said, no, I'm not on the radio at the moment. And he said, why not? And I said, well, because I've just done a year at Jazz and I really enjoyed that. And I said, I'm looking for an adventure. I am looking for an adventure. My children are getting older. I need something that I'm really going to learn from but laugh at as well. And he said, no, I can offer you lots of cover. All of our shows are taken. I can offer you lots of cover. And very sweetly, he said to me, my door will always be open to you, but I think you deserve better. I think you need to go and find your adventure. And I came to see Tony and I met him in a little coffee shop. And he said to me, you know, obviously I know of you. I wanted to meet you. He rang me 2 weeks later and said, would you do some cover at Christmas? And I said, yes, I would do that. Came into the building. They were really, really, really lovely. And I thought, you know, maybe... this is a nice place to be. The people are lovely. It's like grown-up radio behind the scenes. You know, there's not political. You know, because there's always going to be a little bit of that. If you're working with egos, there's always going to be that. Not here. And I thought, that's really interesting. He called me and he said, we'd like you to present Mellow Magic in the evenings. You can do one evening a week, two evenings a week, whatever you want. We'd like you to do it. And I said, I'd like to do it. And he was as excited as I was. And then I started and I came into this building and I met lots of old friends and couldn't quite believe that this place existed. It really is a very lovely place to work. And once again, I feel blessed. I'm very happy with my regulars that are, you know, contact me on social media and we spend our evenings together. It's all very cosy.
Alison in Migla Morgan says,
I'm enjoying hot chocolate, watching the rain run down my window.
Do you know what? When I walk into a studio, I'm happy. Even when I was done for 4 years of overnights at Capital, to just get in there, even if you'd only got in there because you'd had six strong coffees and everything, happy to be in front of a microphone. Just really happy all of the time. So lucky. So, so lucky. Oh, I saw George Michael being interviewed just before he died, and him being so dismissive of how beautiful he was as an individual. It's really interesting, isn't it? How would I like to be remembered? I think kind, honest, and the girl that wet her pants all the time. When she laughed.
For more in this series, follow the Radio Moments Conversations podcast.